From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on March 30th, 2010, in Washington, D.C. A 16-year-old girl named Breeshell Jones had just finished sharing a pineapple pizza with her best friend, Rashauna Brown. They were wearing T-shirts in honor of a slain friend, with the shirts reading, R.I.P. They had attended a funeral that day. After the pizza, the girls headed out, walking a few blocks to meet up with several friends who had also attended the funeral. There's something you should know about Breeshell Jones. Well, there's really a lot of things you should know. She wanted to become a chef. She was very close with her mother, Nardine Jeffries. In fact, Jeffries has been described by law enforcement as an ideal mother, the kind that nurtures a smart young child, also protecting her safety. Breeshell was being homeschooled. Nardine just felt safer that way. When Breeshell and Rashauna met up with friends, a car pulled up, bullets sprayed into the crowd. Four people died. Six were wounded. The shooters had used an AK-47 assault-style weapon, among others, and apparently they were upset about the theft of a fake piece of jewelry at a party. A fake piece of jewelry. A mass shooting. Breeshell was one of the four who died. Imagine losing a child to gun violence. What would you do? Nardine Jeffries has become one of the public faces of a movement, and it is not without controversy. She wants political leaders. She wants the world to see her daughter's body, to see the autopsy photo. She thinks that if we see what guns do to the bodies of children, maybe we will change. My guest for the hour is the remarkable Nardine Jeffries, who's on the line with us now. Nardine, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Well, you know, I as I've said to you in previous conversation, getting ready for this program, I wish we were talking under different circumstances. But in a moment, I want to learn more about your daughter. I want to start by just asking you what a lot of people have asked you, which is why you've decided to share the autopsy photo, to share that photo as publicly as we have. Why do it?
Well, first, I'd like everyone to know that I've been showing that photo for almost 6 years now. Yeah. March 30th will be the six-year mark since she's been murdered, and it's necessary. This is what gun violence looks like. This is what gun violence feels like. It's an emptiness. It's not glamorous. It's not beautiful, like you may see it glamorized in a lot of Hollywood movies and even on these video games where you can hit a reset button and the dead bodies jump back up and you start again. That's not real life. That's what the reality of gun violence looks like. And I just feel like that's the important piece that everyone needs to see. You know, I feel like we're living in a society now where too many people are really desensitized to the violence that's going on, and they need to see the real carnage, not pictures of what you used to look like prior to gun violence. So that is why I've been showing the photo for so many years.
Tell us a little bit more about your daughter. I mean, I've read so many stories, but I'd love to hear it from you. Tell us more about Breeshell.
Breeshell was a very unique child from the very beginning, and I know a lot of people listening will probably think or feel that, of course, you're going to say that you're her mother, but that's the reality of it. Breeshell was very, very liked by so many people, and people just gravitated towards Breeshell from infancy, the toddler to, you know, just she was just really unique. Everywhere we went, people, strangers, just approached Breeshell. They thought she was very beautiful. They just, something in her, they just saw a unique light. And that is not something that I've ever experienced, and I've never experienced it since then. You know, I see people, and they're nice people. They seem, they're attractive people, but it was just something like Breeshell was almost like a living angel from the beginning. People would come and pray over her. When we would go to Pennsylvania to visit my sister in college at the time at Penn State, older women would take out their rosary. And, I mean, she was just a unique person and a beautiful spirit. She was very, very helpful. She was a peer mediator when she was in elementary school. And she just had this very peaceful way about her. She didn't like arguments and confrontations. She was always trying to, you know, get her friends to, and peers as well, people she didn't know, just always trying to be the voice of reason for people. So it's kind of, I think one reporter summed it up pretty well, kind of like, you know, it's really ironic that as peaceful as she was and lived, how violently she was, you know, removed from this earth. Mm-hmm.
Where did she get her interest in the culinary arts?
She actually picked it up from me. She for many years said she wanted to be a pediatrician, and that's what, you know, I was starting to groom her for when she was going to Catholic school. I just always thought she was going to be a pediatrician, and then she just, you know, I always loved to cook and still do, and she just would watch me, and I started teaching her more things, and she just picked it up, and I started getting her Wolfgang Puck's cookbooks and Taylor and all these different cookbooks, and she was always on the internet looking up different recipes and spices, so it really came pretty easily and naturally to Brichelle, and then she decided, I want to be a chef, and I said, all right, so I support that.
And you guys stayed pretty tight, even as, I mean, you know, Nardine, when kids go into middle school, then high school, sometimes, you know, they're a little too cool for their parents. It seemed to me that you guys were very tight until the very end of her life. Is that right?
That is right. I was, as a matter of fact, a week before Brichelle was killed, I was riding my motorcycle with the president of my bike club, and Brichelle and her friend had walked to this corner, kind of up the street to a little shopping center, and we were just watching, making sure the girls were okay, and because her friend was out of something she needed at the house, so we were just sitting there, and she came out and said, Mommy, I want to ride, and I said, okay, well, you have to go home. She was trying to get on the bike, and I said, no, we have to go home and put on your gear. I said, so we'll, you know, ride along beside you and watch you go back home like we did coming up. And before we could put our helmets on, he said, you know what, that's really cool. And I said, what's really cool? He said that your 16-year-old daughter wants to hang out with you. And I thought, that's odd, you know, because to me that was normal. You know, I enjoyed hanging out with her, and, you know, I don't think Brichelle ever felt like I was the uncool parent. Not that I ever tried to be cool or fit in with her friends, but, you know, she came to me and her friends all the time for advice. When they had a problem, my daughter definitely felt like I was the mother that knew everything and could help with the situation. So we rode up the motorcycle that night and had a great time, and that was the last ride we took. Mm. She was killed the next it was a Tuesday, March 30th, so that was the last ride we took.
What do you remember about the day that she died?
I remember that day very well. I had left that morning to go to work. Brichelle and her friends were getting ready to attend a funeral of a young man who was killed 8 days prior. They had kind of overslept, as always when the girls are over there, kind of up all night. And she came in the bathroom, and they were getting ready, and I said, she said, don't say anything, Mommy. I'm going to clean it up when I come home. Her bed wasn't made. She always, you know, kept her room really organized, and I said, okay, not going to say anything. I hugged her, kissed her, said, I love you. They were going to the Metro. It was a group of them, and she said a friend of hers' mother was going to get them to and from the church, and I said, okay. So I came on to work, kind of having a weird feeling. Even the night before, I talked to her about people retaliating and hurting people and coming to funerals to kill people and all kind of stuff, and didn't know I was speaking of my own life story, because just a few hours later, my child was gunned down. I came to work, and my phone wasn't working too well. The charge wasn't taken, and I didn't realize it. So I told Brichelle as I was leaving, I'm going to have to, you know, call you when I get to the office, because we kept in touch via cell phone all day. I got to work, and I called her, and I said, just call Mommy at her desk. The cell phone will be on and off throughout the day. You can just, you know, when I put it on, I'll see your text and see what's going on. And she did. She kept in touch, and at 5:30 when I left the office, I actually took the Metro that day, and I turned my phone on, and I heard my alarm in my home disarming, and she said, we made it home. Her friend's mother had dropped them off, and I thought, ooh, I just felt so much relief. But I didn't go straight home. I met another friend that I worked out with, and we went to work out. Her daughter had spent the night with my daughter the night before, and I went to work out, and Brichelle called me as soon as I pulled up. We were pulling up to work out, and asked, could she go drop a backpack off? And I thought, no, you've been out all day. I don't think that's a good idea. And, you know, she was like, oh, Mommy, please, you always treat me like a baby. So I agreed to let her go drop her best friend Rashana's backpack off. That was the story that she told me to get outside. And, you know, she just wanted to kind of hang out with her friends up there. And she was shot. And the prosecutor told me, your daughter was killed because she was doing her last act of kindness, which was buying pizza for the young men out there that said they didn't have, you know, money to get anything to eat. She and her friends had already bought pizza and had eaten in the home, but when she went back out, she bought more pizzas for the guys, and that's when the shooting took place.
Everything I've read indicates there was some kind of a fake piece of jewelry stolen at a party. I mean, what was the genesis, as you understand it?
That happened on March, I forget the date, 22nd, I'm sorry, for Jordan Howe. He was the young man's funeral they attended. It stemmed with a fake piece of jewelry that this guy named Sanquan Carter thought had been stolen from him. He had laid the bracelet down, and one of the girls that was at the party picked it up and put it on and thought it was pretty, and they left. And he became irate, called his brother and some other guys, and they came down, started to pat people down and started to shoot. And he was in the car talking to a friend or a cousin or someone, and he was killed. His brother and best friend recognized most of the shooters because, you know, they all kind of knew each other, and they were actually friends and played on football when they were younger together. So they then went and retaliated and shot Sanquan Carter's older brother the next day. And that's when all this plot came into play to do a retaliatory type of, you know, revenge shooting on Jordan Howe's friends and loved ones. So their plan was to go to the funeral and attack the funeral. But they didn't get a car in time. So when they saw the young people standing out on South Capitol Street that day, that was the next best thing because they were, you know, some of them were obviously associated with Jordan Howe, who they had killed a week before.
My guest is Nardine Jeffries, a mother in Washington, D.C., whose daughter was killed in a mass shooting 5 years ago. I don't want to dwell too much on it, Nardine, but because most of us as parents, thankfully, won't be going through this, but too many, I think, are going through this. Can you even characterize what it was like to get a phone call? Did you get a phone call? How did you find out that you'd lost your daughter?
One of the young ladies who was with her, who had spent the night before to go to the funeral, I was working out with her mother, and actually, it's kind of weird. I just started feeling that weird feeling that I was feeling the night before when I was speaking to Bruchelle and her friends about, you know, to be careful and things happen. You know, people do mean things and they will retaliate at a funeral. I didn't know all the circumstances that I learned about this fake bracelet and someone being shot. I didn't know all of those details. I just knew a friend had, someone they knew had been killed. I didn't know all of those details at that time. But anyway, I actually started to call Bruchelle's phone. I just felt like my daughter needed me. Something wasn't going on right, and I started to call her. But before the phone rang, a full ring, which was kind of unusual. She always answered almost on before it got to that, you know, full ring. And it rang into a second ring. And then the friend that I was working out with, her phone began to ring, and she answered it, and it was her daughter screaming in the phone that everyone was dead. And I just kind of snatched the phone from her because my daughter's phone was still ringing in my left ear, and I grabbed the phone, and I said, "Where's Bruchelle?" And she just screamed, "Everyone's dead. Bruchelle's dead." And I was like, "What do you mean Bruchelle's dead?" And she was like, "She's dead. She's dead." And I just lost it and ran out the house. I had on shorts, didn't have on shoes. I didn't care. I was like, you know, ready. We have to leave now and try to get to the scene of where Bruchelle, you know, is.
That was Rashauna Brown calling you. And
that was not Rashauna.
Oh, that was not Rashauna.
Yeah, Rashauna was with, Rashauna was her also shot. So she was not able to call. The other young lady was with them who called. Her name was Derica. She was not shot or injured.
Rashauna was shot and survived. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. I mean, I can't imagine as a parent going through that. I can't imagine what Rashauna Brown went through in that moment and since then. And, you know, Nardine, it wasn't that long after losing your daughter that you decided to show the picture. And if our audience wants to see it, you know, we caution you, it's a graphic image, but this is reality. I posted links to the stories on our Twitter account, @EvanDawson, and I think you should look. I think you should see it. you decided that you were going to show that picture. Do you remember the first time you showed it publicly, Nardine?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
It was at a hearing at the D.C. Council, and, you know, they were having a hearing on judiciary and safety, and I just said, you know, no one feels safe, you know, when young kids and anyone with a pulse can run around with automatic weapons, I don't see how you can say that this is, you know, that the public feels safe, you know, that these are the military-style weapons. You know, she was shot with the AK-47 bullet, and I understand there are two sizes, and she was shot with the larger size bullet, which is about the length of my finger, and I, you know, no one wanted to see the photo. They all gasped, people turned their heads, and I just demanded that, you know, don't turn away. Look, this is what's burned into my memory bank. This is what I have to live with every day. My only child that I put so much love and energy into, a child that worked so hard to do what she was supposed to do as a child. She wasn't, you know, an absconder from a youth facility. She wasn't a juvenile delinquent. She wasn't, you know, on drugs. She wasn't anything that, you know, like society likes to put, you know, stereotypes on people of color. She wasn't a bad human being. She was doing all of the right things, and she was not at the wrong place at the wrong time. She was in her community where I pay taxes, where I work hard to try to help other young people in my community, you know, do the right things. So when I hear people saying things like, oh, my God, she was in the wrong place at the wrong time, that really angers me, because if your own community, a movie theater, a grocery store, a park, you know, a first world country that we live in is the wrong place at the wrong time, then I need to know where the right place is.
What a great point, and what a frightening point. The image is hard to see. Let our listeners know, how many bullets struck your daughter, and where did they hit her body?
One bullet struck her in her right temple and blew off the left side of her head, and she was also shot in her left shoulder, and it was a big hole. I mean, there are other photos of Brichelle's body. I just use that one. And I, honestly, I've kind of edited it to a way that it's not the full, image of what the head looks like. But I feel like it's enough for people to get the point that this is what your head looks like when an AK-47 bullet hits it, or probably any high-powered, you know, weapon hits you. Steel and flesh is like oil and water. It does not mix.
I would even say, Nardine, in looking at the image that you're talking about, that the most striking part for me was below the chin, down, I guess, near her shoulder, where you can see, you know, the way it tears through muscle and bone.
Well, that is the autopsy photo. Mm-hmm. So that, honestly, that's where the medical examiner had cut her, and I don't know why he didn't sew her back. At that part. So that is not actually from the bullet. I thought it was at first, but when I spoke to the medical examiner and the physician at the hospital, he said, no, that just was, he didn't sew her back. He did the rest of her body, like coming from hip up, but I don't know. But to me, you know, I just felt like I don't want to edit that out, even though it's not the actual injury from the bullet. The fact is that this was a healthy child, and she had to be cut so they can take fragments of metal out of her body for a trial. So that's why I left that piece in there and didn't just show the head injury of the gun wound, but I also showed what, you know, had been done partially to her body. You know, I'm not exposing my daughter's entire body because obviously when you have an autopsy, you're naked. So I'm not going to expose that part of her. But, you know, I just felt like this is what people need to see. You don't have an autopsy unless you're dead. So I just felt like this is, to me, a strong point and a powerful point. Why is a 16-year-old healthy child at no fault of her own having to be cut open? I have to know how much my daughter's brain weighs and her heart and her lungs and her last meal. That's not, you know, that's not something someone should have to endure. None of us should have to live like that in this first world country. We're not living in Afghanistan. We're not, you know, fighting ISIS here. We're not, you know, this is, again, America. At least this is, you know, so people come here by the droves every year to make a better life and a better living. And to be honest, some of those immigrants are just like Brichelle. They're being gunned down. You leave a third world country thinking you're coming to a better place to do better, and then you're gunned down. People are sticking guns in your face and blowing your heads off because they want to rob your stores and or you take your cars. That's not normal. That's not okay.
So you have these photos of Brichelle's body, and you've shown them to lawmakers. And from what I've read, lawmakers have said to you, I don't want to see that. Is that generally what they say? They kind of turn away?
Yeah, they do. They do. They turn away. They don't want to see it. They don't want to deal with it.
What do you say to them?
You know, and then I've had some that were like, oh, God, you know, I just can't even imagine. But unfortunately, those few that feel that empathy, it's not enough of them because you see what's happened. They're still not voting the right way to pass universal background checks.
What do you say to them if they tell you, I don't want to see this?
I don't care. This is what I have to see. This is what I do see. And sometimes as they were walking away or, you know, I'll just stick it there. I know they can see it, whether they, you know, want to see it or not. They've seen it.
We're talking to Nardine Jeffries, who is telling the story of the loss of her daughter, Brichelle, who was 16 years old when she was out with some friends and a car pulled up and sprayed bullets into the crowd. An AK-47 assault-style weapon was used in that murder. Four people died. Six more were wounded. And Nardine believes that showing the images of what happens to a child's body is one way to make people realize what is happening, how to make change. Nardine, I've got listeners right now who are asking, and I've posted some links to some of your stories elsewhere. Where would you have them go? I mean, I know it's a strange and difficult question to answer, but if they want to see the photo themselves, where do you have them go?
I think probably where you have them is probably the best place for them to go. I mean, I have photos on my Facebook. As you said, you have, like, links to the Trace newspaper, which is the recent article that I've done. But I think, honestly, if you just Google Brichelle Jones' name, you probably will see the photo.
Yeah, it's B-R-I-S-H-E-L-L, Brichelle Jones. Let's get a short break. We're going to come back with Nardine Jeffries, and we're going to talk about, as a parent now, what she thinks should happen next. We're also going to have some commentary from those who oppose some of her efforts, who say that it's unreasonable to target certain styles of weapons, that we are blaming the weapons and not the people. I see the phone ringing. If you want to call the program and join the conversation, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK. Short break and more with Nardine Jeffries next. Coming up in our second hour, we will meet the local winners of the annual EFFI Awards. That's the Ethical Business Awards. We'll talk about who won and why. What does an ethical business mean in 2015? What do they owe their customers, their employees, shareholders, even the environment? All of that and more next hour on Connections.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Bond, Schenick & King, a full-service law firm with 11 offices serving companies, not-for-profits, municipalities, and individuals in New York State and nationally. More at bsk.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Nardine Jeffries is the mother of Brichelle Jones, who died in 2010 in a mass shooting. And Nardine has been willing to show photos, an autopsy photo, images of her daughter's body. Her daughter was shot in the head and through the shoulder and died that night. And if you remember the story of Emmett Till in 1955, Nardine and her story are being compared to Emmett Till, the 14-year-old boy who, the African-American boy who apparently whistled at a white woman or was flirting with a white woman, two nights later was pulled from a relative's home He had his eyes gouged out, was beaten, shot in the face, and then left to die in a river. And Emmett Till's mother decided to have an open casket funeral and let the world see what it looked like. And some of the publication of those images helped mobilize sentiment at that time. Nardine, I know you've heard the comparison before. Is this the kind of comparison that is it a fair comparison? Do you feel that way? Do you think of Emmett Till?
At the time I did it, I honestly did not. I just did what I felt as a mother, as a parent, as a human that I had to do and needed to do. But once the comparison was made, I thought, you know what, that's a good comparison, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It did change the way people looked at things and started change, and I think we're on to some of those same things. You know, I've talked to other survivors who are willing to do the same things now and starting to do it. So I think it makes a difference.
But Nardine, some say these shock tactics are just shock tactics, that they're that of course it's jarring to look at the image of a child's body after the child is killed with a bullet from an AK-47. But let me read another listener. Jake writes, "I'm not a big fan of shock tactics, but given the legislative apathy and it being Nardine's personal experience, I can't help but approve. My biggest question is, what specific gun laws is she advocating for? With gun laws, I worry about those with good intentions trying to implement bad laws that don't help victims, don't penalize criminals, and vilify and penalize responsible gun owners." So let's start there, Nardine. What do you want to see happen?
Well, I think that's a good point, but I'm not trying to use a shock tactic. I'm using a reality tactic. This is real. This was once a vibrant, living human, and she's no longer that. I don't oppose our Constitution. I don't have any issues with Second Amendment rights. My father was in the military and knew how to use all types of weapons, so did his brothers, which are my uncles. I also had I have a lot of family who's law enforcement right here in the District of Columbia that are detectives, retired now, and a cousin who's active on the police department now. So I don't have a problem with guns. I have a problem with guns being in the wrong hands. I have a problem with certain types of guns. Certain types of guns, in my opinion, are for the military and for the, you know, law enforcement agents. I don't think everyone with a pulse should have the right to bear arms, because not everyone with a pulse is responsible enough to be a gun owner. And that's where I think people need to understand. I'm not out here trying to take anyone's guns, and nor is the United States government. We just don't think that, you know, violent repeat offenders like these guys that had weapons that killed my daughter shouldn't have had a gun. It shouldn't be that easily accessible. I live in the District of Columbia. There are no gun shops in D.C. There are no gun ranges, but yet there are a lot of guns on the streets. They're being trafficking over from states like Maryland and Virginia. So that's the problem. We need to, like I said, you know, work on some gun trafficking issues and laws. We also need to have universal background checks. If you are committing a crime, there are certain things that you should not be able to do anymore. I mean, when you go to prison and you come out of prison, you've done your time, but what do they tell you? Now you're not able to vote. There's certain things. I'm not necessarily saying I agree with certain things, but on that. But as far as weapons are concerned, like I said, you know, we can regulate a woman's body and tell her what to do, but we can't regulate where guns are going, where they're going in communities. We can pop a trunk and anybody can buy a gun just like they're buying a soda or a bag of chips. No, that's not right. But it's like I said, if you're a law-abiding citizen, by all means, I have no issue with you, because guess what? If you are a responsible gun owner and you're abiding by the law, this shouldn't be an issue for you. Only criminals are concerned about guns being taken from them.
On the subject of background checks, let's get a phone call. This is Jim in Henrietta on with Nardine Jeffries. Go ahead, Jim.
Nardine, I got to tell you, I'm sympathetic to your family, but I'm just not seeing your point. Number one, anybody with a pulse shouldn't have any kind of gun, but should anybody with a pulse have their freedom of speech? Secondly, clean up the lifestyle of a generational problem of the inner city, and you don't have this situation you're stuck with, ma'am, in all due respect. And background checks, for people buying guns out of a trunk, you think they give a damn about a background check? You're just spinning your wheels.
Well, like I said, I mean, I know that you know, we're never going to live in a flawed society, but it will help. I mean, people are comparing, like, when there was a time when we had the issues with seatbelts, it was proven that they were helping to reduce, you know, deaths and injuries when you were in a car accident. So, yes, there does need to be some kind of regulations with guns. I get that criminals are always going to be criminals, and they're always going to be maybe a step or two ahead of people, but I don't think, again, that everybody should have a gun. I don't disagree with you about cleaning up a lifestyle, but that doesn't mean that only the inner city individuals are having a problem with guns. This is not a black thing. This isn't a poor thing. This isn't a Washington, D.C. thing. This isn't an urban thing. This is a human thing. And people are being gunned down all over the United States of America, with all due respect to you. So maybe you're not keeping up with the news, because people are being gunned down every day, whether they're in school, walking down the street, at a bus stop, in a school, a grocery store, movie theaters, everywhere.
Yeah, Nardine, we've got a world where
we do need to, like I said, regulate who are having weapons.
All right. Well, Nardine, we live in a world now where suburban kindergartens are now doing drills on what happens if a mass shooter comes in. So to Nardine's point, that's right. I mean, this is not just happening in one place. But let me ask
you. This is what happens when you're speaking about guns. You know, it's always a group of people that, you know, when people look like me, the victims, that's a problem. We'll clean up your community if you stop doing this and you stop doing that. And just like I said earlier, we don't have gun shops in D.C., so please tell me where the guns are coming from, since you think we need to clean up an area. Help us clean it up. Help us fight laws that will prevent guns from coming into our community.
Now, Nardine, you don't seem to be in favor of a full ban for assault-style weapons. Is that correct? Are you in favor of banning and confiscating assault-style weapons?
I don't think assault weapons should be in everyday citizens' hands. No, I think they should be with law enforcement and with military. That's what I feel.
Okay.
But do I think, you know, because I can pass a background check, should I be able to get an AK-47? I don't think so. I think, you know, a handgun is fine to protect your home. I don't think that AK-47 is needed to, you know, have the right to bear arms and protect your home if you feel like an intruder comes and you feel like you live in an area where it may take the police 25 minutes to get to your home and that's not enough time. So, no, personally, I don't think everyone should have an assault style weapon.
Nardine, this summer in Rochester, on August 19th, just outside the Boys and Girls Club on Genesee Street, there was a mass shooting here. It was a stolen AK-47. Three people were killed, four were injured. Young people, you know, this community was rocked by that mass shooting. That was a stolen weapon, AK-47. I think it's essentially the same kind of weapon that killed your daughter. So when we talk about what happens with these weapons, it's not always easy to use words like confiscation or things like that, but do you fear that if we don't do that, that criminals will find a way to get access to guns? In other words, it's going to be a long road to reducing the number of if you want to call them assault-style weapons out there, but do we need to start down that road of trying to get them away from the hands of citizens at all, even if they're quote-unquote law-abiding?
And, you know, that's kind of tough. You know, it's, you know, my thing is, again, if you're doing the right things with your guns and locking them up, because there are people, children who are picking up guns in a home that are registered, that have them legally, that, you know, have passed all the background checks, and unfortunately they're not securing them properly, so you're still having, you know, injuries or deaths. I think I don't have all the answers to everything or to, you know, to this topic either, but I think that we have to start somewhere. Like I said, you know, to do nothing is just costing too many more innocent lives to be lost. So if it means that, I mean, we have to take away a little bit of someone's personal preference over here with the gun, and I think, honestly, citizens that are doing the right things with their weapons, I don't think that they would necessarily mind, okay, if I have to give up an AK-47, but I can keep a shotgun, or I could keep a, you know, this type of gun. I'm not that familiar with guns, so I don't know all the names. I don't think that would bother them if they knew that it's going to make it safer for all Americans, and it's going to mean that the wrong people are not going to have as much access to the guns. And, you know, and honestly, another thing that needs to be done, back to kind of what this gentleman was saying about cleaning up things, we need to clean up the judicial system. We have judges that have the right to revoke probation. They need to start doing that. They need to stop allowing repeat offenders, you know, abusers, and all these people that should not have a gun in the first place to use their courtrooms as a revolving door. There's a lot of cleaning up that needs to take place. And it's not just the inner city. Like I said, there's the judicial system. There's a lot of places that need to be cleaned up. But, yeah, I just think, you know, for anyone to have an assault weapon, look at what's going on. We've seen it. We see it every day. Like you said, a gun is stolen, and there's no repercussions behind it. So maybe if we can tighten up laws with straw purchases, that will help, you know, eliminate some of this stuff. Because if I go and buy a gun legally, but then I sell it to someone that I know could not get a gun because they're an ex-offender and they're a violent repeat offender, where's the accountability on me as the law-abiding citizen to put guns in the wrong hands to go out? First of all, why is a criminal buying a gun? Guns do one or two things. They either kill or they injure, depending on how good you shoot. And that's why a lot of these criminals go for these automatic weapons, because they are not trained to shoot the weapons properly. They don't go to gun ranges. So they like a gun that can spray out bullets, several bullets, in a very quick amount of time, and they are more than likely guaranteed to hit a target. So we have to start somewhere. Like I said, you know, it just means everybody working together. And I think people need to understand that's what I'm saying, working together. I don't want the government, first of all, it'll never happen. No one's coming to take all of your guns. But I'm just saying we have to do better in this country. We all deserve, and we have the right to live and live safely. Children should be able to grow up. I, as an adult, should be able to grow old.
Well,
and the way it is now, it just seems like we're all sitting ducks. You never know when someone's going to walk into your studio and start spraying. You don't know when you're in the grocery store. That's the kind of fear that we're living in now. That's the anxiety I live with every day. And I don't think that's okay.
I want to get your characterization on a couple of people who disagree with you. And one of them is the leading Republican running for president right now. That's Ben Carson. He was asked during a Facebook question and answer session about the recent Oregon tragedy, 10 people killed at Umpqua Community College on October 1st. And he was asked if that has changed his view at all. And here is what Dr. Ben Carson responded on Facebook. He wrote, quote, "I grew up in the slums of Detroit. I saw plenty of gun violence as a child. Both of my cousins were killed on the streets. As a doctor, I spent many a night pulling bullets out of bodies. There is no doubt that this senseless violence is breathtaking, but I never saw a body with bullet holes that was more devastating than taking the right to arm ourselves away. Serious people seek serious solutions. The left would prefer to use these tragedies to advance the political agenda." Nardine, what do you feel when you hear that?
Well, I feel that, you know, first of all, I just look at it as someone's right to bear arms is just that. You do have a right to bear arms, but I also feel like humans have a right to live in a safe environment. So like I said, you know, let's get to the root of why some of these people are picking up guns. You know, I don't even really, to me, he's just, you know, somewhat of a madman. Maybe he's been, you know, again, looking at too many dead bodies and desensitized to it, and it really doesn't affect him anymore. I don't know. I can't really speak on it. I don't know him, don't really care to know him. But my thing is, like I said, there should never be one kind of, you can't go from one extreme to the next. Like I said, you can't say we're going to take everything from someone just so this can happen. And that's not what I'm saying, and I don't think a lot of gun advocates are saying. We just want, like I said, some common sense laws here and some, you know, come to a good medium that's going to work for everyone. And that's just pretty much what I have to say about that.
Yeah.
You know, someone's right to bear arms, great. As long as you're doing the right things, that's fine. Be a safe and responsible gun owner. I can't drive a car without a valid license. I can't drive it without my insurance being paid. I can't drive it if there's, you know, the tires aren't. There's certain, you know, responsibilities that come with owning a gun. And I think so many people don't focus on that. You know, it's like, okay, I just want a gun. I want a gun. We glorify the gun so much in this country. But, you know, can we get back to, you know, the looking at, like they said, children are the future. Let the children live it. Let's have a better future.
To sort of counter some of what Dr. Carson is saying, he's saying that the right to arm ourselves is being threatened. And, you know, even
the right to arm yourself is not being
threatened. It's not.
That is not true.
Yeah, it's just not true. I mean, Nardine Jeffries is my guest for the hour.
It is not true.
She
lost
her daughter 5 years ago. She's become a national figure in this effort to sort of wake people up to the violence, the way gun violence impacts children. She's willing to show pictures of her daughter's body. And yet Nardine Jeffries is not, nor is very many people I know, calling for full-scale confiscation. And just as a point of fact here, we know there's roughly 300 million guns in this country. We don't have a good number for how many are what you would call assault-style weapons, AK-47s and the like, maybe 3 to 4 million, so 1%. So even if there was a confiscation program of just the assault-style weapons, 98 to 99% of guns would stay legal. So I just don't really understand what Ben Carson is saying there. Let me get back to the phones. Steve in the city of Rochester is next. Go ahead, Steve.
Nardine, you have my total sympathy. You know, I have a 17-year-old son. If I lost him, I'd be devastated too. But I can present, you know, something that's not quite as, not as dramatic as what you went through, but still pretty dramatic when you live in that moment. And that's because I drew a gun on another man at the defense of my son. I prevented a rape of a woman because I was armed. And, you know, when I lived in the city of Rochester at 3:30 in the morning, there was a woman laying in the street screaming for help, covered in blood. Nobody went to her aid but me, right? And that was because I was armed. Uh-huh. In all three of these situations, I never had to pull a trigger, right? But I could show a picture of my son who's alive, a woman who was not raped, and a woman who got, you know, taken care of before she bled out, right? So there's two sides to all of these things. And I think, you know, when we talk about the two sides, I, too, want to keep guns out of the hands of the people that did the mass shooting in Rochester. But I want to do it in a way that makes sense. And what is being called common sense gun control is really nonsense when you look into the depths of it, right? And I can explain why. So with a semi-automatic rifle, and these things are getting labeled as assault rifles. Well, they're not really. They're not military-style assault rifles. They're not full auto. They don't have three-shot bursts. They're simply semi-automatics where the next shell gets loaded, right? And if you've ever seen, typically the so-called ARs use a 223 round. So a 223 round is just a little tiny bit bigger than a 22. So when most people think of a 22, they think of something that's relatively benign. But the thing is, in a rifle, it's going to have more gunpowder, so it's going to have higher velocity, right? But the problem is banning these so-called ARs is just going to push people to shotguns. And I can tell you with certainty that a shotgun, even a simple pump shotgun with number 4 buckshot and 24 projectiles per shell is going to be far more devastating than an AR. And with a simple pump shotgun, you can put on a spreader choke that's going to spread those 24 projectiles out horizontally. And with 3 trigger pulls, you could probably clear a classroom. As opposed to 30.
Well, like you said, I think you know, when you're speaking about common sense, this to me makes perfect sense of what you're saying. Someone like you come to the table and share the information and work together. Like I said, I don't think that everybody in America should not have a gun. I just think, like I said, the wrong people shouldn't have a gun. What you did was, obviously, you're a law-abiding citizen. You were armed, and you saved, you know, intervened and saved the day. You were a hero, and there's nothing wrong with that. That happens. But what I'm saying is when you have a madman or someone who's high on some kind of drug and some kind of abusive person running around with a gun or drinking all the time or whatever the case is, that's not a good mix. So
I totally agree.
So what you're saying, like I said, I don't have any issues with what you did. That's the proper way to me, that's a responsible gun owner. You have a gun, you were armed, you saw something going down, and you were able to prevent it. Right. I don't have any qualms with that at all.
Let me jump in here as the host because...
But the problem is now I am a felon. Let's say I had an AR before the SAFE Act, right? Let's say that I chose not to register it because it's going to lead to confiscation of my AR down the road, and I can't let my son inherit it. So it's backdoor confiscation. Same with my magazines, my 30-round magazines. I had to get rid of them, right? But that's really another form of confiscation.
Did you have that night when you were able to save the woman from being raped? What type of weapon was it?
I had a .45
a handgun
on me.
Yeah, it was a handgun.
My point is, what was wrong with you
using the handgun? I mean, you prefer a different type of weapon over another. Is that what you're saying?
In that situation, a handgun made more sense. But the point I'm making is that a simple pump shotgun with number 4 buckshot and a shell that holds 24 projectiles and a spreader choke is going to be far more deadly than any AR with 223s and a 30-round magazine.
But Steve, let me ask you just a couple questions because I think that this is, I'm really glad you called. I don't doubt your story for a second, and I think this is actually a very productive conversation. I'm with you when you say you don't like hearing it military style. I mean, I understand the concern that some gun owners have about that characterization. On the flip side, you sort of make it sound like a musket. I mean, it's not a musket. It's not a full auto. It's not a musket either. And the people who are using some of these in a mass shooting situation, you think they don't know that they haven't considered the idea that the shotgun you're talking about could be more deadly? I mean, how come people aren't using them?
Well, let's take Adam Lanza, for example. If Adam Lanza knew what he was doing, he never would have used an AR. He would have used a semi-automatic shotgun with a spreader choke and number 4 buckshot, and he could have been far quicker in cleaning out classrooms. Quite frankly, that's the honest truth. So what's going on with a lot of these mass murderers, they're more focused on how they're going to look in the look of an AR and how badass it looks, when in reality, they'd be far more effective with a semi-automatic or a buckshot.
Right, but you just said they're not going to use it because it doesn't look cool.
That may be, but to be honest, a gun... whether it's a, like you said, a handgun, a .22, or some, you know, missile launcher or anything in between, guess what? The gun in the wrong hand is the problem. Guns in a responsible gun owner's hand is not my concern. It's not my problem. That's not where my issue is. My issue is with someone like that has mental problems, that has anger problems, that has, you know, that has no business basically having a gun. We wouldn't have to have all of these dialogues with so many different people if more people were like you and doing the right things. But unfortunately, the situation is not like that. It's too many people are getting guns, and they're not good people, they're wrong people. And you're right, they don't really know guns. I don't know guns. And that's why they pick a gun because, hey, it looks big and they look, like you said, a Rambo or badass or whatever. So they go pick up these kind of weapons. They have no business having a gun in the first place, whether it's a small handgun or a big, you know, semi-automatic, automatic, full automatic. They don't have any business having a gun. And that's what I'm focused on. I'm not really focused on, at this moment, what type of gun and who have, you know, we have to, like I said, sit down and understand better some of these weapons. But right now, I just focus on the wrong people having a gun, period. I don't care what kind of gun it is.
No,
they don't need to have them.
I understand, and I want to thank Steve for his call, only because we're about to run out of time with the hour. I've got to move on from his call, but I will say, I wish Steve's story, again, which I don't doubt, was more the norm. You have a handgun, you use it in a way that protects people. What we do know is that Steve's story is essentially the outlier. The handguns are used much more likely, if you've got it at home, 22 times more likely to be used accidentally to kill a child or injure a child, to be used in domestic violence against a woman in a homicide, or to be used in a suicide. We know that. I wish it weren't the case. I wish there were a lot more Steves out there. But I appreciate his call, and I also appreciate the fact that he called. He may have a difference of opinion, but he called this program to talk to you, Nardine, and you welcome that call. And that kind of dialogue,
that's what
we need.
That's what it's all about. You know, we need to have, you know, an open dialogue. It doesn't have to be, you know, that we can't agree to, you know, and agree civilly. You know, he made some good points. And like I said, with him calling now, I have some more research that I need to do and things that I need to think about. But, you know, like I said, at the end of the day, I still believe not everyone with the pulse needs a gun. But if you're right, if more people were like Steve and more responsible with the gun, I think society would be a much better and safer place. But that's not the reality. We don't have, you know, everyone with a gun is not like Steve.
Well, Nardine, we're out of time. I just want to say on behalf of the audience, no matter where they stand, they've heard your story, and we are so sorry for what happened to your daughter 5 years ago. And I am just amazed at the work you are doing, and I'm honored to have you. I don't even know what else to say, but thank you, Nardine.
Thank you.
Nardine Jeffries has been my guest, a mother who lost a 16-year-old daughter to gun violence 5 years ago. I've posted her story on our Twitter account at Evan Dawson. When we put the show up for a podcast, WXXINews.org/connections, we'll also put up her story so you can find it there. And I hope we can come back and talk to Nardine another time as this conversation continues, and it must. Short break, more connections next.